Radio Time, Samardi Mas Cohen. Michael Solomonoff is a very successful award-winning chef and restaurant owner here in Philadelphia. His restaurant Zahav, that serves up Israeli cuisine, is known across the country. He and his partner Steve Cook have opened other popular and highly rated restaurants in the area. Solomonoff will be featured in a four-part PBS series about Israeli food, and he has a cookbook in the works. While he was building his restaurant empire, he was keeping a big secret. He was addicted to heroin, crack cocaine, and alcohol, something even his partner and wife knew nothing about. Solomonoff has been clean and sober for about 6 years now after going into rehab. He came clean, so to speak, in the New York Times on Sunday in an article by Frank Bruni about his double life. We asked Michael Solomonoff to join us once again on Radio Times to talk about his battle with addiction, the upcoming TV series, and his passion for Israeli food. And Michael, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for doing the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I mean, how does it feel to be so now sort of out in the open? It must have been tough to tell friends and family, but now
yeah,
people that don't know you know this.
I know. I don't know. You know, every hour it sort of changes. It's been a big week. I felt good about it, and I feel sort of relieved. So, and I think it's been good, and I think I've gotten a lot of, obviously, friends and family and peers have been supporting me throughout this, but especially now. And, you know, even the last few days, I think there are a lot of people have been reaching out saying, you know, I've been struggling with this, thank you so much. And a good friend of mine, actually, who's a chef, relapsed a little while ago and told me that this was sort of the kickstart that he needed.
Wow.
So it's good, and it was worth it.
Why was the time right for you? I mean, obviously, you must have thought about this before being interviewed by Frank Bruni.
I think that, you know, we just always have so much going on all the time, and it's hard to plan things. We have restaurant openings, children, all this stuff. And I think that I was followed by a great writer named John Marchese for a Philly Mag sort of bio last year, and you know, we hung out for about 4 or 5 days, and I was pretty frank with him about everything, but I wasn't ready, I think, I basically didn't want my parents to, like,
really
read all that. I was, you know, I wasn't embarrassed.
They weren't ready, perhaps?
I don't think I was ready, and I don't think everybody was ready. But since then, I just sort of, you know, I just became ready, I guess. And yeah. And the more press and the more accolades and all this positive stuff that we get, I think it's you know, there's a sort of like juxtaposition thing that's happening. It became more important for me to be honest about it.
Was that what ready meant? That it was time to be honest?
Yeah, I think so. And the details, I mean, obviously make probably for a great story too. So, I mean, other people are interested. You know, maybe it would be less romantic or exciting if, I don't know what, if I got a DUI or something, but just as dangerous and just as severe.
So what's it like to be sober?
It's great. It's great. I mean, it's the best. It's the best thing. There are a lot of cliches that you sort of have to hold on to for hard times. But what was it? I heard this once. Somebody said, I don't regret any of the decisions. And I believe this. I don't regret any of the decisions I made. This has given me the opportunity to recover, which has been the greatest gift. So it's true. I mean, my life is great. It's not without, you know, hard times like anything else, but it's fantastic.
So when do you think, or how old were you, when you probably started to have problems with drugs and alcohol?
It's hard to say. I mean, looking back, I had all these, like, addictive tendencies that even as a kid, like a small kid. I would, like, compulsively eat candy or, you know, I, like, felt sort of comfortable cheating on tests or just... things that seem insignificant at the time are like sort of a peer pressure thing, but things that I felt the most comfortable doing.
Taking risks?
Yeah, absolutely. Taking risks, doing things that are maybe a little bit shady or dangerous or whatever. So, you know, I was sort of characterized by that, I think, at a young age. And then I think that like experimenting with drugs and alcohol, which you think is sort of normal. I just happened to be very good at it, I think, and I felt the most comfortable sort of doing it.
Oh, I mean, so you felt more comfortable as yourself if you were high, for instance?
I think so. I mean, I think there's this sort of, you know, I for a long time wasn't very comfortable in my own skin. And it wasn't, you know, I grew up with loving parents. We had a great house. I went to a great school. You know, everything was in place for me to do just fine, you know, but it's, you know, if you, you know, have depression or if you have like low self-esteem or whatever it is, it's just, it's much easier to not be around, to not, you know, emotionally be present.
Do you think you had depression or?
I think struggled with depression? I think so. I don't think any more than probably anybody else. The way that I deal with it though is obviously different.
Right.
So,
I read. I guess you went to college for a couple of semesters.
I did.
Smoked a lot of pot, or did a lot of, and also well, sold it too, right?
I mean, I did. I did. I'm not proud of it, but it's kind of the way it went. And I think that at the time, it didn't seem that crazy. I mean, you know, I know plenty of friends, people that have done very well in college or very well in high school or, you know, have dealt with trauma in their life and they don't, you know, they don't react the way that I do. But at the time, it just seemed okay, you know, and I guess you hear this a lot too, functioning addict or alcoholic. And I'm like, well, it's only functioning until it's not, until something, you know, until the door, you know, the trapdoor drops and or opens or whatever. So I think that for a while, it just seemed like I was, you know, pretty extreme in my partying or whatever. It didn't seem like that abnormal.
You mentioned the word trauma, and your brother was killed. This was back in 2003.
Yeah.
He was in the Israeli military at the time, killed by a sniper.
Yeah, he was, it was on Yom Kippur, 2003, so it was October 6th, and he was patrolling, like, the northern border, on the border of Lebanon, and was killed by Hezbollah snipers over the border. So yeah, I mean, it sucked. It was really, really hard. And
was that the spiral down for you?
That was it. I mean, I think, like I said, I've always sort of had this addictive tendency, and I guess I've always been, you know, a drug addict or an alcoholic, or at least had that sort of mindset. And I think this was just a trigger,
meaning that the drugs or the alcohol were just a way of sort of masking, obviously, the sadness, the loss, all the feelings that you were having at the time?
You know, it was, I guess I thought I was coping with grief, but, you know, a lot of people, like I said, choose other ways to cope. And I think that it was just easy for me. I mean, I just was more comfortable sort of not being present.
Right. And not feeling, perhaps?
Right. Right. Not feeling, not being present. And, you know, I could justify my actions because of this. So it became, you know, it's, you manipulate a lot of people in active addiction, right? And dead or alive, you manipulate a lot of people. And I think that was sort of the case. I think at some point, you know, it wasn't me grieving. It was me justifying my use.
Justifying it. I mean, in a sense, using your grief as an excuse to to do drugs.
To get high, yep.
Wow.
I know.
I mean, you used crack cocaine, you used heroin, and you also at the same time were working, opening restaurants, you know, thinking in business terms.
Right.
How were you able to do that?
Well, I mean, I was surrounded by people that were incredibly hardworking, caring, creative, you know, loving. I mean, all these things. I did a lot in addiction. You know, I met my business partner, opened businesses, met my wife, got married, all those things. And I don't really know how.
Yeah. And they didn't know.
I mean, I think probably looking back, there were points, and certainly towards the end. But you know, you are, it's like an insidious disease, and you become very good at lying and manipulating. And that was like one of the hardest things to do after I became committed to recovery. It was just not lying. You know, it just was not spewing out lies all the time. It was how I sort of lived.
One of the things that Frank Brunet writes, and obviously you told him this, was that when you were married, you would sneak off in the middle of the night. I mean, your wife would be asleep. You would sneak off and do drugs or find drugs. And then in the morning, sneak back into bed.
Right. Right. I know.
And then
go to
work?
Yeah, go to work. Sleep for a few hours or not and go to work.
And would the drugs sort of help keep you up?
I don't think so. I was a lot younger then, so maybe I had more like natural energy or something. I don't, you know, maybe they did. I just don't think, I think that, you know, had a certain amount of stamina and energy, and it eventually faded, though.
But you need denial, too, don't you, to be able to do that?
Oh, my gosh. The most denial. You know, I think about it. I had all these, like, little checklists of things to do, and it was like, don't get high at work. Don't, you know, all these things. You know, don't have, like, X amount of paraphernalia, and then I'm not a drug addict. And, you know, for 5 years, I told myself I could quit whenever I wanted. Which is crazy.
And were you not high at work? I mean, would you, you would sort of do this?
No, eventually. I mean, all those things that are on that checklist eventually go out the window, you know, and all the things that you'd never picture doing, you know, eventually happen. So towards the end, yeah, all of it sort of went out.
Your wife and your partner really had an intervention. I mean, they mm-hmm. saw, they began, I guess they saw what was going on with you. Was there a precipitating event?
I think that it just, like, the lying eventually didn't work. And, you know, we were under a lot of pressure when we opened the restaurant, and I needed to sort of be a leader and be, you know, be all these things that I really wasn't being. And being, you know, being a husband that was there physically and emotionally, just, you know, I wasn't that either. And it was just, eventually it just became obvious, you know, and there was no lying that I could have done to sort of make up for it.
So what happened at this intervention?
I mean, it was very, I guess, what you'd see on, like a Lifetime original series. You know, I kind of knew it was happening when it happened. I woke up, and my wife pushed me down the steps and said, you need to come downstairs. And Steve and...
Your partner.
Steve, yeah, my business partner, and Aaron O'Shea, who's another one of our partners, and my wife were sitting in the living room of my house, you know, and I was wearing a bathrobe. And I think Steve said something like, we know that you have a problem. We want to take you to detox. And... you know, I made, like, a beeline for the backyard.
Did you want to escape?
Well, I did, but it was, like, I don't know. You know, of years and years of really keeping this in, it was the first time I had this sort of opportunity to just tell the truth. And I took it.
And it was that hard? I mean, to face your wife, your close friends,
partners?
Yeah, I mean,
it sucked. You know, I'd been lying to these people for so long. My wife, you know, we were married. I mean, for years, you know. And I'd been using my dead brother is an excuse to not be around, and I'd be, you know, for grief, or and use my position as a chef to, you know, kind of do whatever I want, you know, do whatever I wanted at work. And, you know, Steve and I had, you know, everything sort of invested in these restaurants. So it was, yeah, it was hard. It was definitely very hard. But at the same time, I, like, went to rehab and detox and slept the best I'd ever slept that night after coming clean. So
Let me hold on, just only because we have to take a very short break.
Thank God.
hopefully this is not too hard for you, Michael Solomonoff, but we wanted to invite him to join us once again on Radio Times. He's a local celebrity chef here in Philadelphia, and his restaurants have gotten all sorts of awards. He's got a new one, and he also told a New York Times reporter about his problems with addiction, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Unfortunately, our phones are down. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
There is a stunning lack of hydrangeas in bloom wherever winter's polar vortex polaxed plants. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what you must do if you want to see flowers next season. Plus, answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. and noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden runs an agency that's exploring the outer limits of the universe, but he got his start on Earth in the segregated South.
My being here is very improbable. If anybody had asked if I would be here when I was growing up in South Carolina, I think the answer would have been a resounding no way.
We'll talk with Charles Bolden next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michael Solomonoff. And he and his partner Steve Cook are very successful restaurateurs here in Philadelphia. They specialize in Israeli cuisine, Zahav, Federal Donuts. They've got a new one called Dizengoff, and they're about to open a new one called Abe Fisher. And while they were building their restaurant business, Solomonoff was living essentially a secret life, hooked on heroin, crack, cocaine, and alcohol. He's now clean, went public this Sunday in a story in the New York Times, and that's in part why we invited him back on Radio Times. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. So what was rehab, as you say, rehab and detox? I mean, I'm thinking about sort of that the you walk in the doors. What did you expect?
I didn't know. I'd done a stint in rehab in college, so it was different. I mean, I was more established, and I think my ego sort of had a lot to do with
it. Were you ready, though? Do you feel like you were finally ready?
I was definitely ready. I mean, I think it wasn't, you don't just go and stay someplace for 2 weeks and come out and not be a drug addict anymore. So it's a lot more than that. But, you need to get sort of removed and go through the process of acceptance. It's a big one.
But it's interesting that after this intervention, you said that was the best night's sleep you had had for years.
Yes. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Because you could finally be yourself?
Well, I felt like it was like the first time in, I was 29 years old, so it was the first time in my life I'd really been honest about anything. And that was, a tremendous weight lifted off my shoulders. And that, of course, went away the moment I had to, be clean and sober forever.
Because that's the hard part, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And heroin and crack cocaine, I mean, I imagine those drugs and people kind of nodding off as opposed to running a business.
Well, or nodding off or being super wired.
So, or super wired. Yeah. I mean, for you it was...
I think it was everything. So, but that behavior was so... Everyone expected it for so long. Mm-hmm. Or I'd been sort of accustomed to it, so I could play it off and say I was really tired. I mean, we just opened a restaurant, of course, or I'd been up all night because I couldn't sleep because I was upset about whatever or stressed out, and make plenty of excuses, and people eventually accept it.
So did you have to learn to be honest?
Yeah, I do. It's every day you gotta try to be honest. I think that when I don't really obsess about drugs and alcohol anymore, but if there's an urge to not tell the truth or to whatever, it's something, I have to pay attention to that.
You said an interesting thing in the Philadelphia Inquirer that wrote a piece about you a couple of days ago, and this was when Zahav was opening, and you had this special room, the Quarter, where you would serve up these amazing meals for people.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a dual menu restaurant, and you say addiction is super self-centered and utterly selfish. I thought the Quarter would be how people would judge me as a chef, showing off my stuff with 4 separate canapes, an 8-course tasting, and extras to take home. But it was so self-indulgent to ignore the other 100 people in the restaurant. To worry about the few who are eating these fancy little plates is a lot of stripping of the ego before you can move forward. I thought that was a really insightful thing that you said.
Yeah, I mean, you're constantly trying to find these parallels and analogies that sort of make up what it is. And you do a lot of reflection. And at the time, it was just everything was so unfocused. There were a lot of factors that made Zahav a success. It wasn't just me, not doing drugs, even though I don't think it would have, obviously it wouldn't have worked out with me and Steve or me and my wife or any of these other people or any of the staff that was there that obviously knew what was going on. A lot of things sort of happened in tandem that we're happy about now, needless to say.
How hard was detox?
It wasn't that bad. I was on, there was a drug that was given to me called Suboxone that was I could taper off of the, I didn't get withdrawal symptoms from the opiates, and that was helpful. Mm-hmm. But it's all the addiction, the mental sort of obsession is a tough one. So it wasn't just I walked out of there in 10 days and was I'm fine.
The mental obsession is just thinking about
Well, it's just, you know, you spend, you know, almost your entire life. Like I said, it's so self-indulgent, so selfish. And you spend your entire life thinking about, you know, how you're going to get away with whatever it is or where you're going to score, or, you know.
It's a lot of work.
A lot of work. Full-time job.
We have an email from Barbara. Can he, meaning you, comment on what he said to Craig LeBan? Quote, I feel like you can have a better impact if you tell your story before you die.
I mean, I know. That sounds really insensitive. I guess in the last year, it seems like a lot of people are sort of dying.
Well, I was thinking of Philip Seymour Hoffman, certainly Robin Williams.
Right. From my perspective, it's really hard to watch people, even publicly or celebrities, but, you know, anybody that relapses after being clean and sober for a long time, because it doesn't get any easier. So you're worried about it. You don't know if they're ever going to make it back, you know. And for somebody that's been clean and sober for 20 years to start injecting heroin after that, you know, it's like you just don't know what's going to really happen. So it's, I guess, on one hand, it's good to be able to talk about this and be very present. And the other hand, it's, you know, more accountability for me. I mean, this sounds totally selfish, but there's something about being completely open to the world about this. I mean, anyone sees me falling asleep on a park bench, like, hopefully they'll say something. My wife will certainly be there. My business partner will certainly be there. My staff, who I was very open with when I came back from detox, is for that reason. I needed accountability.
Do you think you could have died, though? I mean, if you had sort of kept going the way you were going?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there were hundreds of occasions where I could have been dead, you know, in those 5 years. And I got away with not, you know, luckily ever getting arrested or hurting anybody, which I could have done any single night that I was out. But I've realized, I mean, over with the experience that I have, I mean, I feel like if I were to go back out or relapse, those things would happen.
And it must be. I mean, you know this city so well, so I would assume you know where to go.
Right. Yeah. It would be pretty easy.
Yeah. But I also read that your family, your wife, keeps the money from you and kind of monitors your behavior.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit less so now, but the first year I didn't drive by myself. Steve would pick me up every morning from a 12-step meeting that I would attend and drive me to work, and my wife would pick me up from work and drive me home. And if there was any, like, money, you know, out of our account missing, obviously it was like kind of a red flag. Yeah. I didn't carry. I mean, I don't. You know, I'm better now. I drive obviously by myself, but I was very diligent about that for the first year. It wasn't a good thing.
You feel like you owe them?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I owe everybody. Yeah, without a doubt.
And that's Michael Solomonoff, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. As I said earlier, a very successful restaurateur here in Philadelphia. And we've been talking about something that he told Frank Bruni in the New York Times on Sunday about his battle with addiction, being hooked on heroin and crack cocaine and alcohol. And again, we can't take phone calls. Unfortunately, our phone system is down here at WHYY, but you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I mean, do you see, I mean, you sort of put yourself out, you outed yourself in a way, and being interviewed about your addiction. Do you feel like you have a message for people in terms of understanding what this disease is all about?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I've been trying to think about it. I think it's just important to be, to sort of expose, you know, my experience. I think that would hopefully make things easier for people that are struggling. You know, so I don't have, there's no, like, stay in school or anything like that. I mean, I think it's really, if you've got, you know, if the stars have aligned and you are, like, have a little genetic disposition or predisposition to be an addict, or, I don't know, you just like to drink a little bit too much. I mean, I think that inevitably you're going to have to be faced with some decisions, and families, too, are going to have to be. And I think that's a huge thing. I mean, a lot of people don't, you know, I get tons of, like, press, right? And it was important for me to, you know, to sort of be humble and to also be honest about, you know, how I got into this. I mean, I've been supported, like, through thick and thin with all these important people in my life. And, you know, the more press that we got, the more attention that we got that was positive. I mean, it's super fragile and delicate.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think it's important for people that are going through those issues to understand sort of everything.
How did your parents react?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, to me going to rehab and getting clean, or to me to reading?
Just the whole thing, I guess.
You know, my parents want obviously the best for me, and they're proud. So I think it's challenging. I think it was really hard for them, you know, when I was in rehab, obviously, and getting clean. But they're very respectful and very supportive and very open, which is good, which is what had, you know, sort of had to happen.
As you said, you felt like you used your brother's death as a sort of an excuse to use drugs.
Yes.
Do you think about him differently now? I mean, now that you don't have the drugs, do you feel like you've been able to actually mourn his?
That's a great question. You're absolutely right. I mean, after, you know, I thought I was doing that for the 5 years of being out and out sort of in addiction, and it obviously didn't work, you know. So yeah, it was I got to really sort of experience and to deal with it after, which is a little bit tricky because it's obviously really emotional, and you know, my coping skills weren't established. My like positive coping skills weren't established, so it was a little bit hard. But yeah, it's been much better.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of work your way up to it, right?
And so you can
incrementally.
Right, and you're also now, you know, you're sort of trained to be open, right? If I am feeling a certain way or really upset, it's, you know, I have to call people and talk about it and be open about it. And it's, you know, it's you to not be alone in this sort of struggle is the key. And to be able to share these problems with people that understand, I think, has been...
Yeah. A revelation maybe for you? I mean, the idea is that you don't have to do this all yourself.
Right, right, exactly.
We have an email from LJ. My experience with solo was great. Losing it was a huge part of my recovery. I was fired for good reason by Mike. Oh, and it hurt so much. It was from then on I wanted to get clean.
Wow.
Can you explain? I don't totally understand what I just read there. Who's LJ?
LJ is a really good cook. He actually worked for me at a restaurant.
Oh.
So, yeah.
With a similar story, perhaps.
Clearly, but what he didn't know is that I fired him while I was hiding my addiction. So there you go. Sorry, LJ. We're open and honest now, right? So yeah, that was a big problem. You know, it's the restaurant industry, I mean, has sort of, there are a couple, I guess, a stereotype that people like to drink and use and all that. And it was a little bit difficult to have to reprimand people or, like, make decisions like that when I was hiding, you know, a much worse sort of secret.
I mean, your restaurants have alcohol. Is that an issue for you? I mean, do you have to be careful? Can you be around that and people drinking?
I can. I mean, I don't, like, go out to bars and, like, hang out late at night or anything like that. I mean, mostly because I'm, like, old and tired and want to, like, eat cereal and watch television in my underwear at home. But I...
Like the rest of us, like if I can say.
Right. You know, I'm careful. I don't, it's weird because, like, I drugs and alcohol are part of my story, and everyone's like, well, it must be hard to have people drinking at your bar. And I'm like, well, not really, because, like, it was never like sit and have like two beers at the bar. It was like wait till everyone goes to sleep, you know, and then take off for like 8 hours. So I can't, you know, I don't relate to any sort of casual like use or drinking or anything like that. So it's not a problem. I'm okay.
I mean, it sounded like kind of a manic kind of energy that you must have had to live this life.
Yeah, I mean, I still might have that energy. Uh-huh. I can can express it a little differently now, thank God. But yeah, you know, I think that, you know, my story is like everybody else's story, to be perfectly honest with you. Everybody that's gone through this, regardless of the severity, regardless of the drug or the alcohol that they used, have, you know, they've had to experience this. They've had to, like, not sleep. They've had to lie to everybody. They've had to do horrible things and manipulate plenty of people. And there's millions, tens of millions of people that have done this. I just happened to open a restaurant that has luckily not closed. You know,
yeah.
I've been surrounded by... I've been blessed to be surrounded by people that were so accepting and so supportive. And that's not always the case. And you know what? Had I kept relapsing, it wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't have them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, right, I guess sounds like right time, right place when this intervention happened, that for whatever reason, perhaps you were ready.
Yeah.
Or wanted
to.
Maybe?
I mean, just like the sort of addiction, you know, sort of took hold of me again. It was like wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
You know?
What are meetings like? Are they helpful to you?
Yeah. Really, really.
A place where you can be with other people and,
yeah,
and speak about this stuff.
Yeah, they're awesome.
They're awesome. We have an email from Monica. Do you think it was easier to get clean for you because of your social standing and supportive family than someone with a lower social class or perhaps less support? I'm just quoting off the email there.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a weird question. As I just said, I think that had I continued to relapse, then it wouldn't have made a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I think that it really just comes down to the individual wanting to recover, you know? So it made it easier, but it also made it harder. I mean, we, you know, on day 50 of me being clean and sober, I had to, like, call my dad to, like, borrow money to make payroll at Sahav because we were doing so terrible. You know, it was right after 2008.
Oh, sure.
You know, I think that there were some different pressures. I woke up out of, like, drug addiction to, you know, a wife of 2 years and a business partner and a huge business and a huge staff. And, you know, those aren't exactly the easiest circumstances in which to, you know, get clean and sober. Mm-hmm. So I really think it's based on the individual.
I know you're not in the business of giving advice, but I wonder, as you think about the kind of support and family that you have had over this difficult time, what was the most helpful to you? I mean, obviously people intervening and being there for you, but it sounds like someone had to read you the Riot Act as well.
You know, there were a couple points where it occurred to me that the only way to get through this was to be super honest, which meant that if I had... You know, if I had a thought at work, which happened every second of every day for like the first 6 months, I had to just open up about it, right, which is hard. I mean, it's really, really difficult. So Steve and I spent obviously a lot of time together, and I would just, you know.
The thought meaning?
You know, like, I want to go use. No, I want to go use. You know, it's like, it's, you know, everyone talks about sort of triggers in the beginning, and the truth is that everything is a trigger. Right. I'm like, it's sunny out. I want to go use. It's, you know. 8 o'clock in the morning, I want to go use. We've had a bad day or things are going well. It's all the same, right? So, you know, for the first year, I mean, I would, you know, to this day, I'm pretty open too. But, I mean, you know, Steve and I would figure out how to, like, run this business or bring it back from almost failing. And I would, you know, talk his ear off, man.
Right.
Poor guy.
And he listened?
Yeah.
I mean, was that the most...
Probably the most helpful. I mean, obviously, my wife, you know, being so diligent. And she would... For a long time, she would give me surprise, like, drug tests.
Oh. So she didn't quite trust you.
She should not have trusted me. Absolutely not. She should not have trusted me at all. And she had every right to do that. And to this day, we have, like, a drug test that she never sort of gave me. And I'm like, don't ever throw that out.
Oh.
You know?
Just because.
Yeah. Just because, right.
Cause just because. That's Michael Solomonov, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We've been talking about his struggles with addiction. Also, we will be talking about the fact that there's a PBS special that he's involved in having to do with Israeli cuisine and certainly his life in the restaurant biz. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Next time on The Pulse... 8-year-old Nadir Tinsley is an active boy.
He's doing karate, and I thought about football.
But he has a rare debilitating disease that affects about 100,000 Americans.
He gets transfused every 3 weeks to prevent him from having a stroke.
A look at sickle cell disease and why there are not better treatment options. The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
We now live in a time of endless possibility. More has been learned about the treatment of the human body in the last 5 years than was learned in the previous 500.
The new Cinemax series, The Nick, is set in a turn-of-the-century New York City hospital. It's directed by Steven Soderbergh and stars Clive Owen. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the show's writers and the medical historian who advises them. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Go home and stay home.
We already had a law in the books that said they needed to be inside by midnight.
It's like looking for a needle in a haystack and then adding more hay to the pile.
Do you know where your kids are at 9 p.m., 10 p.m., or 11 p.m.? Cities experiment with curfews and law enforcement faces new challenges dealing with at-risk youth. Conversation next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Michael Solomonoff. His restaurants here in Philadelphia include Zahav, Federal Donuts, Percy Street Barbecue. He and his business partner, Steve Cook, just opened a new restaurant called Diesengoff earlier this week, and they'll be opening another restaurant in Center City, Philadelphia called Abe Fisher. He is the star subject of an upcoming PBS special called The Search for Israeli Cuisine, and I should also repeat myself in that we've been talking about his battle with addiction, something that he talked about in the New York Times on Sunday. And again, taking calls at Radio Times at WHYY.org. That would be, I guess, an email address, rather. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Michael, this is an email from Megan who says, thank you so much, Mike, for your openness, willingness, and honesty about your addiction. As a parent of two sons in their 20s who are in recovery, everything you say is so close to home and so familiar. As a mom, I can say I'm so proud of you, but mostly so happy for you that you have found recovery, a caring mom. And this is from Megan. Have you been hearing a lot from people like Megan?
Yeah, I have. I have. And it's been probably validates sort of what I'm doing. So, yeah, it's been great.
Make you realize just how, I mean, certain ways how common addictions can be.
I mean, I think they are common. And I think that for a long time, it was probably sort of a taboo to discuss it. So it's been easier. And honestly, it makes my recovery stronger. And I'm sure this hopefully will have a positive impact on Megan and her two sons.
And her two sons as well. We have an email from Anonymous. The food at Zahav is the most amazing food I've ever had. It's like...
That was me. I actually
emailed myself. Exactly. It's like alchemy. Can he talk about his approach to creating dishes? And I do want to segue a little bit into this PBS special. I saw a 5-minute, preview of it, and I have to say it made my mouth water. But in part you grew up in Israel, part in the United States.
I was born in Israel, but I grew up in Pittsburgh, and then when I was 15, my family moved back. So I spent a year there, and then back to the States for a few years, back to Israel, and then here I am.
So feed in both,
yeah, exactly.
In both cultures.
Exactly. Well, what's interesting about the food that we cook, and this took a long time this took like a few years to really get comfortable and figure out our identity. But we take a look at the Israeli food and Israeli culture, which are many, many different cultures, sort of put in one place. And I guess we're sort of like a third, our narrative is a little bit different because we can sort of stick all those things together and have this Israeli cuisine.
Well, and as I said, the clip that I saw talked about something like 70 different cultures, all influencing this small country and the food there.
Yeah. I mean, it's from a cooking perspective and from a dining perspective, it's really stimulating. And, it's also in the sort of like great agricultural sort of, Mecca. There's like all this... just the farming there is amazing, and everything, nothing really sits on the back of a truck. Nothing travels for a week to get there. It's all...
Because it's all so small, right? The size of New Jersey, I'm told.
Yeah, it's like a little island, yeah.
And did you grow up with a family of cooks, of food lovers, food enthusiasts, foodies?
Yeah, luckily, I mean, not foodies, like we weren't foodies, but like everybody in my family loves food, and my mom's a really good cook, and my dad's a good cook, and my dad's... my father's mother was like probably the reason I cook.
So your grandmother?
My grandmother, and she was from Bulgaria and immigrated to Israel in 1948. But she was Sephardic, so her food is just amazing, really, really good. But my mom is like a great cook, and I'm lucky actually. My mother-in-law is a great cook too, so it's I'm surrounded by good food. I was the pickiest eater for.
Oh, I was just going to ask you about what kind of eater you were.
Oh my god, I used to like take cheese off of pizza, wipe the sauce off, put the cheese back on. It was the worst. I know. It gives hope for my children.
So when did you start cooking, I guess, seriously, or get interested in food seriously?
Well, actually, when I dropped out of college, I moved back to Israel and got a job in a bakery, and I really like loved it. And then, got a job at like a cafe. I was like a short order cook and knew that I wanted to to cook after that.
Because?
I just loved the, I love sort of creating things. I mean, I think I was okay in school, you know, but I really was like so restless, and it was to be really busy and to be under a lot of pressure and to do sort of like, you know, hard work and to create things that were delicious and that, you know, the gratification is very quick.
Mm-hmm.
You make something good,
it's
hopefully.
It's either good or not.
It's either good or not, or people like it and this, you know, years later we realize there's this like emotional connection to everything and that is just so satisfying.
Is there a favorite time for you at a restaurant?
Favorite time?
I mean, I don't know, being the first person there or having it to yourself or when the evening is over or in the hubbub.
I know. I don't really eat out at a lot of restaurants, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Probably not late anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. For the reasons that we've been talking about.
Well, I guess so, but I'm just like, you know, like I said, like I want to be at home drinking tea on my couch at like a certain
in your underwear watching TV,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
You opened this restaurant. It's called Dizengoff.
Right.
And it's hummus.
Yeah, it's
what
it's,
what does Dizengoff mean?
Dizengoff is the I think it was the first mayor of Tel Aviv, I believe. And there's a famous street in Israel, like a circle, like a promenade called Dizengoff Square. And it was like really sort of popular in the '80s, much like South Street, I think, here.
Uh-huh.
And when I was in boarding school we used to sleep on like the park benches in the circle too. But so we were sort of into the name, and we've got this sort of like 80s rock kind of motif of all these like old Israeli rock posters on the wall. And we wanted to do a hummusia. It's like a very sort of traditional thing in Israel. It's just hummus. Like they make hummus. When they run out of chickpeas, they close, you know. So we make hummus and pita, like fresh pita in an oven there. And we get a couple little salads and pickles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you still enjoy cooking? I mean, when you have several restaurants and you're running a business, is there still pleasure in cooking? Do you get a chance to do that?
You know, I wish I could cook more. I mean, I'm like the chef or whatever, but I mean, the truth is, you know, my business partner Steve and I make decisions, including food, everything kind of together. So, and Aaron O'Shea is like the chef and partner of Percy Street. Mm-hmm. And I, through all this, realized that I just love being the chef of Zahav. Not as the owner, but I really love working in that restaurant. I just like have a great time. So regardless of how we grow, I still want to be at Zahav, and I work the bread station. I used to work it, you know, 6 nights a week. I work it probably three, four nights a week, and we have like a little chef's counter that I'm there. So I like working at Zahav like the most of all this stuff.
Is it also kind of theater in a way? I mean, just working in or running a restaurant like that?
I just like, you know, it's like the gratification thing. Like when I work at Zahav, I work the bread station, which means that basically every single person at the restaurant gets hummus or like laffa and salad. So I get to physically make food for every customer, which, you know, is a hard thing to do. Is any chef is really difficult to do. So to be able to do that and to be a part of like the sort of magic that I think that we provide is the best.
And again, that's Michael Solomonov, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a number of things, including his restaurant businesses or his restaurants here in Philadelphia. Again, a PBS special called "In Search of A Search for Israeli Cuisine," and we've been talking about his battles with addiction. He was addicted for a time to alcohol and to crack cocaine and to heroin. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. So does food taste different now that you don't do drugs?
That's a good question. I think it does. And I think that you can actually focus on food, not like where you're going to get money to go score next, you know?
That was kind of constantly on your mind?
All the time, or how to keep it sort of alive. But yeah, I mean, cooking is about honesty. You know, it's really, for me at least, it's such a visceral thing. It's when you're not really focused on that or really on sort of hospitality. And I know this sounds really cheesy, but, you know, when you're not focused on, like, making it really nice for the guest all the time, you're not really doing your job, I think, as a chef or as a restaurant person. So, you know, obviously being preoccupied with, you know, drug use or alcohol use or all these sort of selfish things made it maybe less effective as a chef or as a restaurateur. Food tastes, I think food, I think your palate always changes. So I think it's kind of hard to say. I mean, obviously you're a little bit more in tune to things when you're not sleeping like 1 hour or 2 hours a night. Or you haven't been smoking like a million cigarettes or, you know, whatever. But for a long time, I thought that I couldn't be a chef because I couldn't like use drugs. Like that was like the edge that I had, which is not true, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's one of those denial things.
Sleeping 1 or 2 hours a night. I mean, you could do that night after night after night after night.
Yeah, I mean, it took its toll.
I mean, there must be nights that you had to just crash.
I would, and that sort of happened at the end. That's when I couldn't. That's when like it no longer became doable. You know, the active addiction thing, and I would like, you know, I would like show up late to work, which I never, you know, never would do before. But I would like sleep through my alarm, and you know, show up at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Everybody would be like freaked out, which is I'm lucky it happened. You know, I'm lucky that happened. That was the first sort of indicator, I think, for people.
But do you think you were a good actor? I mean, the fact that you could cover your tracks, your trail so effectively.
Yeah, I was a good actor. I was a good unpaid actor.
And I guess, I mean, certain ways a good liar, I guess, on top of that.
I really think that's sort of par for the course. You know, when you have this sort of addiction bug, that's kind of how it goes. Because you can't, you know, there's no other way to really keep it up.
Have you found that there's addiction in your own family? I mean, that there's a way to sort of understand maybe yourself in the context of the rest of your family?
Definitely not. You know, I was a little bit, I didn't grow up, like my parents never used, they were never into drugs, and we didn't really drink either. It wasn't like that. I think that like maybe a grandparent or something, but not, it wasn't overt at all. And certainly, you know, my behavior, especially in adulthood, was like not, I couldn't relate. They certainly couldn't relate to what I was doing.
Right. But you said you did go into rehab in as a younger person.
Yeah, I went in college right before I dropped out. I went, that was sort of like a, you know, obviously a shock to everybody to call my parents from rehab to tell them that I was going to drop out of school because I was in drug rehab. And
what kind of drugs were you using back then?
I was using like cocaine mostly. Mm-hmm. And I mean everything, but mostly that. I think that was sort of what I was like obsessed with at the time.
As I said, you know, talking while people are, I think, sort of recovering the shock of the death of Robin Williams. Obviously, he had severe depression, killed himself. But nonetheless, he also had spent apparently a lot of time in rehab dealing with drugs and alcohol. We mentioned Philip Seymour Hoffman as well.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see those as helpful, not helpful in a good way, but stories that can help people understand what addiction is and just maybe even the power of addiction? Here are these two, and yourself included, three really successful people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is it. And I think the sort of like image of like the sort of like poor, you know, addiction affects everybody. And if it doesn't affect you as the individual, it affects your family, which in turn affects you. So, yeah, of course. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to watch. Like I told you, seeing interviews with Philip Seymour Hoffman, being, you know, proud of being sober for 20 years and then going through that cycle again of like picking up and going, you know, and I think he went to rehab for, you know, snorting heroin, and then he was dead from injection a few months later. It's not a surprise. It's not a shock, but it's terribly upsetting and, you know, so upsetting and so sad for his family and, you know, for their fans. But I think it paints like the actual picture, a legitimate picture of what addiction is. And you can be clean and sober for 20 years, and if you're not on top of it, it's just going to come right back out.
So something that's on your mind, obviously. I mean, something you have to think about.
I mean, I don't really think 20 years down the line. I think of like today and tomorrow.
Right.
And I think of like what I have to do today and tomorrow. And it's obviously a lot easier than it was then, but I mean, if something, God forbid, terrible happened in my life, you'd have to really, you know, really be diligent about staying with whatever sort of program you have, you know.
Your kids are little.
Yes.
Do they know anything about this?
No, you know.
Anything about daddy?
No, I mean, my oldest is 3 and my youngest is like 2 months, and I'm really happy and really grateful that they've never had to see me use. I've never had to, like, steal from them, or I've never had to come home, you know, out of my mind and had like hold them, because that would have made it a lot harder. You know, a lot of people tell me now, well, it must be like really easy because now you have kids, you know? And I'm like, no, I would have manipulated them just like every other person, you know? So yeah, I'm grateful.
You are opening yet another restaurant, Abe Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
What's this restaurant about?
Sort of like the inverse of Zahav. We do more Sephardic Jewish food at Zahav, and this will be more focused on the sort of like American Jewish and like Montreal style, and a little bit of Hungary, a little bit of Paris. Yeah, small plates.
And why is Philly such a foodie town? I mean, this is longstanding. It goes back decades now, but it clearly is.
It's weird. I moved here like over 10 years ago, and I moved here kind of on the way to New York because I thought that, you know, eventually I would end up in New York. But the time I came in, I think Stephen Starr and Neil Stein and all these people were sort of creating this food town. And I think everywhere in the country, I mean, every city is sort of going through this food thing. People are just into food. But
Yeah. There's
something about, I don't know, we just have some really, we have great diners here and we have great cooks here, and it's not that expensive to open a restaurant, and it's great. It's a good time to be in restaurants here.
We're almost out of time here, but I read you consider Mark Vetri a mentor, one of your mentors.
Yeah, Mark Vetri and Terrence Fury are like the reason I probably am where I am today.
As a chef, as a restaurant person.
Yeah, maybe even a good guy.
And maybe even a good guy.
Just debatable, right?
Well, I don't know if you're a good guy or not, but I really appreciate the fact that you came and joined us on Radio Times and talked about, obviously, a difficult time in your life, but I think you have something to tell us, and that's why we wanted to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, Michael Solomonov, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.